very pleased to introduce our first speaker of this session, Professor Femi Oyebode, who's Professor of Psychiatry and Head of Department at the University of Birmingham, as well as being a consultant psychiatrist. So Femi has published widely on the relationship between literature and psychiatry, and as well as taught a lot of these themes about using film, literature and theatre with medical students at Birmingham. He also publishes on descriptive psychopathology and delusional misidentification syndromes, and in his other life, is also a poet and literary critic, so I'm delighted he's able to come and speak to us today about the relationship between madness and the theatre. Femi, thank you.
Thank you very much. Matthew, thank you for inviting me. Thank you to Liz as well for inviting me to come and speak here. I thought what I'd do is just talk for about 20 minutes. And please keep in mind I'm not a Beckett expert. I'm not even sure I'm an expert at anything, really. But I just thought I'd just say one or two things that come to mind. Why is a psychiatrist, why would a psychiatrist be interested in the theatre? Why would a psychiatrist want to come to a day like this? Why would a psychiatrist go to Stratford to go and watch Shakespeare being put on and so on? And I think that it's probably helpful to know that I'm like a card-carrying psychopathologist, of which there are not very many left in psychiatry, because people think that psychopathology is dead, that it's all been described, and therefore we just teach it like we teach anatomy, you know, because the body doesn't change very much, so we just teach it as if it's given. So not very many people continue to read and think about it. And the thing about psychopathology, way to think of it is to say that the whole purpose of it is to observe a person who comes into a room, and to observe their gait, to observe the cadence of their walk, to observe what it is they're wearing, to observe how to go about sitting down, to observe how to talk to you, and not just to listen to the words that they use, but to also listen to the prosody, the music of their language, and then to see how they interact with you. And you're using all of that to deduce what's going on inside the person. So you're looking at all of these objective external behaviors, including the speech, in order to deduce internal experience. And the psychiatrist's interest in the theater is that the performers and the performance in theater uses the same features to suggest to the audience what's going on inside the person. So the actors, they go about thinking about what to wear, what props to carry, how to walk the stage, how to say their lines, and how to lean towards or away from the person they're interacting with, and so on. And all of it to suggest what's going on inside. And it seemed to me that we are, if you wish, mirror images of one another. And therefore, a psychiatrist of my kind, who is interested in psychopathology, who's interested in trying to work out what it is that's going on inside somebody else, is interested in how somebody else knows how to depict that. And who teaches this other person how to accurately depict internal life on the basis of how you externalize it. So that's the reason for psychiatrists, one of the reasons for psychiatrists to be interested in theatre, and of course interested in Beckett. The other thing, of course, is that our trade is, because we're humans, our trade is heavily dependent on language. So we attend to what people say. And of course we know that in the theatre that what people say obviously is constructed. And so it's written and it's created. It's not, you know, it's not fresh, and it's not occurring in real time, being made up and being, you know, we're not, they're not essentially, you know, they haven't to present something which has already been made as if it were just being created now. So we appreciate that. But of course, the wonder of great writing is that it attempts to mimic real life. So it's quite a good way of getting a grasp of how people speak, how it is they go about saying things which are unspeakable, how they tell you something in order to distract you from what they really intend to say, and how they go about lying, and how they tell the truth by being dishonest. So all those tricks that human beings use, they're wonderfully deployed in the theatre so that they help us to sharpen our trade, so that when we are confronted with another person in a clinical space, the more you attend to what's gone on in East End of the night before, or what you've been to see at Stratford, and so on, how it's been done, the more you are attuned to how people portray themselves and how they engage with you, and so on. So that's a second reason for somebody like me to be interested in, you know, what dramatists and the theatre has to offer. And the third, perhaps most complex offering, gift that the theatre can offer us and give to us is unexpected. And it's that, of course, if you take something like King Lear, and you got in there as somebody, the king, who's disintegrating over time, and you got in there as a fool, and then you got in there somebody who's pretending to be mad. Of course, they're all pretending, given it's theatre. But you've got several layers of pretending, so you've got somebody who's pretending to be mad. That calls into question, what are the what are the signs and symbols that an actor uses to speak to an audience, to say to them that this guy's mad? And are those signs and symbols, are they stable over time? Or do they vary over time? So we're interested in that. So as I say, that's a more complex area of psychiatry, the degree to which the signs and symbols of distemper and distress are determined by contemporary culture. And how come, whether the people, the patients themselves, obviously, there's nobody who is lying in bed when he's well, thinking, if I were to go mad, how do I let my relatives know that I've gone mad? Do you see what I mean? So obviously, if such a system existed, then it must be being transmitted by osmosis. Because the person wouldn't know that they're not preparing to go mad, in other words. But somehow, they must have a system, there must be a human system going on, whereby when you're distressed, you know the language to use to express distress. And that is of interest to me, because the actors must be using that to signal to their audience that there's distemper, that there's agitation inside oneself. And as I say, it's quite an important area of psychopathology. So at a trivial level, if I try to exemplify it a little bit, and I don't want to take this too seriously, I'm just trying to, you know, give an idea of what I'm talking about. So if you were a woman in Freud's day, and you were disturbed in some way or distressed about what's going on in your life, you're certainly not going to have eating disorder. You're not going to present with anorexia. So you're going to present with hysteria, whatever hysteria might have meant in the late 1800s. What that is saying is that the what you use to signal distress alters over time. It would have been very, very strange if the psychiatrist practicing in Vienna in 1880 had somebody presented to them with anorexia nervosa. They just wouldn't have seen that. And it's even rarer today. So when I was training 30, 35 years ago, it would not have been uncommon that the person you saw with this emotional distress, who was a woman, for example, might be somebody who has what we would then have called agoraphobia. Now, it's a long time since I last saw a patient with agoraphobia. All right? Of course, I'm sure that my colleagues, the psychiatrists in the room, will be trying to work out, they'll be probably thinking in their mind, well, it probably means that there are differences in family constellations, and that probably determines how people present. But another way of thinking of it is just to say the proportion of distress, of humans who are distressed, is probably the same across all time. But the way in which they manifest it changes. All right, so that's just to exemplify the real case I'm making, which is that for the theatrical performance to work, the actors have to somehow know what it is they have to do in order to let the people watching them know that they're distressed. And we're interested in that. So that's, if you wish, good reason for somebody like me to be interested in these matters. And then to talk a little bit, because I'm not a Beckett expert, really. I don't know anything at all about him or his work. I don't know enough to be standing up, really, to be speaking. But I can take one or two things which I think are of interest. So if you think of Not I that we've seen today, and if you're a psychiatrist or you're a psychopathologist, and you come into a room where there's a focus on the lips, on the mouth, and you're trying to understand that from psychopathological point of view, one of the things that's interesting to me is that, of course, at a very mundane level, the representation of the mouth and the lips and the teeth and the thumb in the homunculus is incredible, massive. So if you're thinking of it as geographical space, it is, you know, the back is so, it's minuscule, even though the back is, you know, from your neck to your bottom is massive in terms of physical space. But in the homunculus, it is just a thread. So when you come into a room and you see a kind of magnification of the mouth, you think, yes, that's interesting. Because actually, that's how the brain sees it. So that's like a concretization of how the brain itself operates. Because in the brain, the mouth captures a lot of territory. Our own lips captures a lot of territory. But also interestingly, of course, our own eyes also are fascinated. Of course, they're very, very fascinated by eyes, but also, of course, they're very fascinated by the lips and what the lips do and how they look and all that sort of stuff. The other thing that a psychiatrist of my kind might be interested in is, and Matthew is the expert on this, so forgive me, Matthew, to steal some of your ideas. It's the idea that that things can rise to the foreground because of how the chemicals in the brain operate. Now, so if you think of our patients, you know, our patients will come into a room and there'll be an empty chair there. And they would know that that is because the throne of England is empty and they're going to be the next king. But everybody else who comes into this room, probably, if they will barely notice that that chair is empty. All right, so there's this process where things come to stand out. Of course, it's happening to all of us because our brain, the dopamine system, is given salience to important objects and events that are occurring all the time. That's how we remember things, and that's how we recognize the things that are significant in our context and our environment and all that. But of course, the patients, one of their problems is that these things are becoming salient for no good reason. So things are standing out for no good reason. And it's a long-winded story, but the point I want to make with it is that when the person comes into the room who you don't know, who is a patient, one of the problems you have is that you are aware of the fact that that any aspect of your behavior or your body can suddenly become relevant. So that you've got this tendency, I don't know whether my other colleagues in the room have this, I hope it's not just me that does it, that you want to mute all your movements. Because, you know, if you blink or move your arm, or it starts to gather momentum, it has to have significance and so on. And sometimes I have noticed that they will, you know, that people will stare and focus on my lip movements. And I thought, oh, yes, you know, this idea of a mouth in Not I makes sense to me because we encounter it in our practice and so on. So the point I'm trying to make there is that there's something about the ability of the writers to have a kind of, how shall we say, to have a kind of intuition about some aspects of abnormal experiences, which if you're just a member of the audience who's not working in this area that we work in, you just take it as a kind of symbolic use or a device to do something in theatre. But we might come into the room and we think, oh yes, I've recognised that, because we see that in the work that we do. I think the other thing I wanted to say, again coming back to the idea of Beckett and so on, is this, because the way I thought of it is that, you know, if you look at how, if you look at, you know, for want of a better description, the theatre of the absurd, that part of the kind of device, as I see it, is this idea that you, you concretize inner experience. So that so the other kind of playwrights are just writing plays where people are engaging and interacting with one another, but that what you're seeing in the kind of Beckett's play is that it is actually the person's mind you're observing. That it is their mind that is being, it's their inner self that's being portrayed. It's not, so that when you, as we just saw in Footfall, where we see the woman walking back and forth and the mother speaking, and you might think, if you weren't me, that that's just a woman and her mother is off stage speaking. And I just think, well, that is a reliving of an experience, and it is an internal reliving of an experience. And that what he's done is that he's just created a theatrical space which is the same as the internal space of the person whose life we're seeing in that little 15-minute clip. So I think that, I find that very interesting, because there are aspects of it which, there are aspects of it which are interesting to us, the way in which you bring other people, other characters in your life, to bring them back into your inner life, and the way in which you hold conversations with them. And he's done that, they're not necessarily there. He is very clever, I think, in playing with the notion of memory, so that the memory, again, because there's no way to externalize memory, he, in Crab's Tale, he can externalize it by using a tape recorder. But it is essentially, he's plunging us into their inner life, so that you see, you try to get a feel for what it's like inside that person. And thirdly, that he has this very wonderful hold on the nature of how memory is structured, so that the a kind of repetitive, iterative way in which we, you know, so if you think of a good way to bring this to life is that if you were to think of a death, more perhaps a better idea would be to look at a tragic death, you know, so if you think of post-traumatic stress disorder, but forget an awkward term like that, and think of the Hillsborough disaster. And if you are, you know, as I have met somebody who, you're watching the TV, you're watching the match on TV, and as you're watching the match on TV, you see your son being crushed to death. And that little image, it recurs. So you go back and forth that image in your mind's eye. And I think he's very, very good at capturing that. So that's that kind of rewind, you know, you go back, you go forward, and you go back and you start again, which is what actually happens in real life. That's how the people, and no matter how often they retread the ground, the material is still very, very fresh. And it's retold with all the freshness and vividness as if it happened yesterday. And sometimes when it's told, you feel as if you were personally there yourself. All right, so I thought that's his grasp of that, ability to grasp that, I thought that's absolutely wonderful, because that's how people, that's the sort of thing that people, patients, tell us, and that's what we observe with them. I thought the last thing that I want to say is the that if you think of language and speech, that the degree to which prosody informs the pragmatics of language, especially in English. So that the way, if you were to just utter a sentence, a simple sentence like, you know, this room is chilly, what you mean by it depends on how you say it, where you say it, with a nice intimate inflection, accent on your voice, who you're saying it to, how far you're standing from them, whether the person who you're saying it to is the person who owns the room, and so on. So the degree to which pitch and prosody, music, determines meaning, it's absolutely key to everything. But of course, I was intrigued to then discover, because I only just discovered it just by listening, that his mother had Parkinson's. Because one of the first things that goes in Parkinson's is prosody. So that, but of course, it's also interesting that you strip out the prosodic aspects of speech so that it's monotonous. And then you ask yourself, what is that doing? What is the purpose of that? Because of course, in real life, where you've got a depressed patient who's got prosodic, or you've got a patient with Parkinson's disease who's got a prosody, you've got difficulty in engaging with them. Because we use the music to do all sorts, to charm people, to seduce them, all sorts of things they're using the music for. So when the speech is stripped of prosody, it is incredibly difficult to engage with a person, to listen to them properly, to feel humane towards them, and so on. So I thought that's interesting that here he's gone and stripped it off because he said, to deliver it as if there was no emotional content in it, as if it was just. And I thought that, again, another from my point of view, another kind of, just a wonderful insight to the degree to which the man understood all the component parts of how language is used, and then also understands how, when you strip bits of it out, what's left, what it may or may not be able to do to the emotional tone in the person who hears it. So I thought that's certainly worth thinking about.